You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Friday, August 21st, 2020.
I think every program that we have, there's more need than there's dollars.
Later in the program, Diane Walker, contributor for the Limestone Post, continues her conversation with Jacob Seip, executive director of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, in part three of her ongoing series.
And each pair of shoes represents a person that would have attended that climate strike.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner covers the first ever shoe strike, organized by Yellowwood Youth, a youth-led environmental group. More on that in today's feature report. But first, your local headlines.
The Bloomington City Council finished its preliminary hearings for the 2021 budget on Thursday night. Among one of the budget discussions was the Bloomington Police Department budget hearing. Bloomington Police Department Chief Mike Dekoff presented a budget of $14.7 million for 2021. This is a decrease of approximately $40,000 from the 2020 budget. The largest contributor to the decreased budget amount was a lowering in the number of maximum sworn officers from 105 down to 100. BPD would then use these funds for two neighborhood resource officers and two social workers. BPD is historically the most funded department in the city, according to a Herald Times report. Over 200 people attended the Zoom meeting to hear the police department budget proposal. Public comment lasted approximately 2.5 hours. During the meeting, council members discussed concerns for budgeting funds for purchases and use of non-lethal weapons, such as tear gas and sponge rounds, as well as gas masks. During the straw poll vote, only council member Dave Rollo voted in favor of the BPD budget. Council members Ron Smith and Susan Sandberg voted against, while Steve Volin, Matt Flaherty, Jim Sims, Sue Scambaluri, Kate Rosenbarger, and Isabel Piedmont Smith abstained. The City Council is able to decrease funds in appropriations, but cannot add money. Council member Jim Sims stated in the meeting that Bloomington is headed into rough times, but will work to do as much as possible for the constituents. The final budget process will begin on September 30th, and a final vote on the budget as a whole will be heard on October 14th.
The Bloomington Board of Public Works approved an operation agreement for seated scooters with VO Ride during its August 18th meeting. City Attorney Mike Roker said the seated scooters cannot be licensed.
Because seated scooters do not meet the city's definition of motorized scooter, they cannot be licensed using the process that's used for traditional stand-up scooters. So therefore, we have the present seated scooter operating agreement before the board for consideration so that these devices can be deployed legally within the city's right-of-way.
Roker said a trial quantity of 25 scooters would be deployed in Bloomington. He said the trial period would last 8 weeks. He said seated scooters are held to the same rules as standing scooters. Director of Economic and Sustainable Development Alex Crowley said VO Ride has a constant watch on their product.
VO Ride has a slightly different and unique approach to how it manages its fleet that other scooter companies typically will remove their scooters and then return them, which means that mostly they're keeping an eye on their scooters at the beginning and then at the end of the day. They remove them to charge them at night. VO Ride has a model both for its stand-up and its sit-down scooter that it replaces batteries while leaving the device in place, which means that their operating model has more of a kind of hands-on, eyes-on-the-street approach, which gives us a greater sense of comfort that any issues related to parking of these new devices can be and will be addressed quickly. And I can let Ben talk about that as well. But that's really the reason for our confidence in launching them, but also our limitation on this, on the size of the initial fleet.
Veo Ride representative Ben Thomas said Veo Ride would hold demonstration events and distribute about 250 helmets to potential riders. Roker described the timeline for the scooter trial period.
It is an 8-week trial period that may be renewed up to 5 times by city staff, provided that our experience with the 25 scooters is not negative. So that would mean a total possible period of 48 weeks before the scooters would have to be authorized for deployment again by this board.
Thomas said 15 miles per hour is the top speed for seated scooters.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti talks to Forrest Gilmore, executive director of the Shalom Community Center, about evictions in Indiana.
Reverend Forrest Gilmore is executive director of the Shalom Community Center, a Bloomington organization that provides services to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. Thanks for joining the local news on WFHB.
Happy to be with you. Thank you.
The Shalom Center just received a $500,000 grant from the state of Indiana. What's the purpose of the grant?
To prevent people from becoming homeless. We are in obviously an eviction crisis here, with the eviction moratorium being lifted just last week. And so there's a great potential for many people who are impacted by the coronavirus, either through their own personal health or through the impact on the economy, that they may not have been able to pay their rent these many months. And landlords now can start evicting people who haven't caught up. So this is to respond to that crisis and hopefully prevent people from becoming homeless.
Right. The governor of Indiana lifted eviction protections for the whole state. Are you seeing reports of people being evicted more in Bloomington already?
Well, we're absolutely seeing people applying in large numbers for this financial assistance, given that we're just very shortly after the moratorium, and the courts, at least locally, are putting delays on when people file and when they go to court. I'm not sure exactly what's happening on the court level, but we're definitely seeing a large number of people apply for the funding locally and throughout the state.
Another local organization, the New Hope Shelter for Families Experiencing Homelessness, received a $150,000 grant as well. Are these grants enough to prevent landlords from evicting tenants?
Certainly some. We have no idea yet how widespread the problem is going to be, because this is unprecedented. So, we're working in our local region here, both New Hope and Shalom, get referrals locally. And so we're hoping that combined $650,000 will, have a big impact on the people who are at threat, under threat from being evicted. But we have no idea yet whether it'll be enough. It's our worry that it won't even come close to touching the problem. But that still remains to be seen as we move through this and see what the actual need is out there.
We don't know when the pandemic is going to end. Between New Hope and Shalom, I mean, how long are these funds expected to last?
Yeah, good question. We're taking it month by month at this period of time. There is more money to be designated that's available. So if the demand is higher than what we've got, there is more that we can go back to get. And the governor recently allocated additional funds to the rental assistance programs throughout the state. And so we're hoping to get closer to that target. But, it's month to month here. And we're looking at seeing how long this will impact people economically. Obviously, we're still and will continue to be into a pretty serious economic crisis for some time. And nobody knows how long that will last.
Right. And that will last and affect our economy as a whole. And at the same time, the state government has changed the laws from affecting a statewide moratorium on evictions to being locally addressed. Do you see that as a benefit, that evictions are being addressed on a local level versus a state level?
I mean, one thing we know, for example, is that we just saw employment numbers, unemployment claims climb again nationally. So So we know that's a big impact and it's going to continue to have impact after dropping. We just saw a really big claim going on. And certainly regionalizing the response with state support is the best way to do it. I think decentralizing is often a smart way to approach things so that you kind of spread out the need and the demand and the work that needs to be done. So I think there's real value in that. But with that eviction moratorium being lifted, local communities, to my knowledge, are not bringing in their own, you know, moratoriums locally. They're just creating the scenario where, as communities, we need to, you know, do what we can to prevent people from becoming homeless, which means basically finding ways to pay for their rent and for their utilities when they are not able to do that.
Would you like to see the governor, would you like to see the state government reinstate that eviction moratorium? Do you see a need for that?
It's a good question. I don't know at this point. We're going to have to really see what the impact of all of this is, and I'm not sure I have a clear sense of what that is. The moratorium has value in that it delays something. It delays the eviction process, but the real issue isn't so much the delaying of eviction as the fact that people are eventually going to have that bill come due. So we've got to find ways to support renters and homeowners as well so that they can, you know, pay their bills or somehow have those bills forgiven.
Reverend Forrest Gilmore, Executive Director of the Shalom Community Center, thanks so much for joining WFHB Local News.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Bloomington's first ever shoe strike is set to happen within the next couple of months as a part of the Yellowwood Youth Organization. WFHB correspondent Katrine Bruner talks with the founder of the organization, Josie Sparks, on the inspiration for the event.
I spoke with founder of Yellowwood, Josie Sparks, who will be a high school senior this year and has spent the past year working endlessly to get to this point. Yellowwood Youth was a result of the work that Sparks did for Project Green Challenge, which is an international environmental education challenge by Turning Green. It includes 30 days of challenges, each with the intent to enlighten, educate, and inspire high school, college, and grad students with environmentally themed challenges to do each day for the duration of 1 month. Last year, PGC welcomed over 11,000 participants from 73 different countries. Sparks ended up being one of the finalists to get a chance to go to California and work with Turning Green. When she applied, she also had to propose a climate action project. Sparks ended up creating Yellowwood Youth with the help of Beth Ratner and Nicola Salzman. The goal of the nonprofit organization is to, quote, provide quality education, resources, and opportunities to young people in Indiana in relation to the environment and the climate, end quote. She explains how the organization began and her vision for its future.
So it started out with, you know, I thought I would have to move to California to make any headway in this. And I was like, I'm gonna have to go to college there to, you know, get this good education. That's the only way I can be successful in this topic. And that's a complete lie. There is hundreds of groups in Indiana doing this work. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of people in Indiana, policymakers, that this is their focus. And they know the details about climate in Indiana. And they're trying really, really hard to make it mainstream here. Outside of Bloomington, it's not picking up so much, but every little town has these little gardening clubs. Every little school has their eco club. It might only have 5 people and they might never start an initiative, but if you can reach out to them, you can help them do that. You know, if I can give them contacts that we make a database of and say, here's someone you should ask that can help you with that, then you can do that. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're not being touched by anything else. So yeah, the idea is like designing things that I want to see that I wish I had, right? Like the ebook, for example, for kids to have that, to know that you don't have to be in policy. You don't have to be this scientific biology scholar. You know, you can use climate advocacy in any way you want. There was a girl that didn't know what she wanted to do to submit for the ebook. And I said, you're good at baking cakes. Bake me a cake. Make each level a different ecosystem. Have the ocean, have the desert, have the, you know, like this is something you can do. Take a picture and we'll put it in. So that's like, that's something that I wish I could have read or could have put in. So that's what we're creating. Mm-hmm. I wish that someone had told me there's so much you can do here. Because if you don't have the money to move away, you can't, and you don't have to. Like, there's all this stuff right here, and you can do it at your age, like at whatever age you are. So really, eventually, we'd really like to have a lot of stuff for elementary through college.
Since October, Yellowwood has been working on many ideas and projects, one of them being the Bloomington Shoe Strike. Sparks explained in detail what a shoe strike means and how it works.
Basically, it's a way to have climate activism and a climate strike without being in person. It's also a donation event that helps the local community. Right. So there will be boxes at select locations, and you take the lid off, donate a pair of shoes that are in, you know, like light condition. They can be a little ratty if they can be cleaned up, but more good condition shoes if you have them that you don't wear anymore. And then you donate them, and we lay them out in a strike, so like all separated in a field or a parking lot. And each pair of shoes represents a person that would have attended that climate strike. So it's keeping shoes out of the landfill and repurposing them for a new life, a new person to wear them. It's giving back to the local community. So a lot of you have like dress shoes or sandals or those kind of things. They will give those to people for interviews, or so we'll like send them out wherever we can where they can be used again, or other people can give them a new life.
People can donate their shoes at their convenience starting September 4th through the 6th and also September 11th through the 13th. Times and dates may be subject to change, but will be published on Yellowwood Youth's social media pages and website closer to the month. The specific locations right now for donating are St. Mark's United Methodist Church, the Bloomington Friends Meeting House, the Warehouse, and Monroe County Public Library. Yellowwood has reached out to Souls for Souls, Middleway House, Opportunity House, and Indiana Recovery Alliance to help take the shoes and repurpose them. Sparks explained the inspiration behind the strike, which started in Sweden, but she said she saw it first in West Lafayette, Indiana, from a student-led shoe strike that happened on July 21st. The team collected 2,500 pairs of shoes in total and donated them to Souls for Souls to, quote, be used for humanitarian aid around the world, end quote. When asked why shoes, Sparks said that there are many reasons why shoes are a good way for environmentalists to express their emotions for taking care of the environment and also help people who are heavily affected by climate change.
Shoes actually have a little bit more meaning than some people recognize at first. So each pair of shoes is a representative of a person that would go to the strike, but you can donate as many as you want. And so the other like meaning behind the shoes is the miles that climate refugees have to travel. So each pair of shoes does not just represent a person from our community there. It represents one of those people that has had to leave their home and try to find a life somewhere else because of climate disasters that we have an impact on. So that's the meaning behind them that I see more so, because people are donating so many shoes, you know. For me, that is a lot more meaningful and more connecting our community to theirs and making people think also about other people, that it's not just about how can we show up here and show that we care, but that we recognize that we're a privileged community. And in terms of Indiana, we do see climate impacts. We definitely do. And some people don't believe that, and we do. But we don't see them in the same way. We're not impacted in the same way. Some people are impacted in certain ways. And if you think about heat levels and apartment buildings and those kind of things, that they have higher risk of heat stroke and heart attack and things like that. So we definitely see it in Indiana. But for a lot of us, we're privileged that we don't have to see it at all. Yeah. And so you never see those people unless it's on a Time magazine.
For more information on the strike and other projects, you can contact Sparks and the team at yellowwoodyouth.org. For WFHB, I'm Katrine Bruner.
Diane Walker, contributor for the Limestone Post, continues an ongoing series for WFHB about rental assistance in the wake of the expiration of the eviction moratorium in Indiana. Today, she continues her interview with Jacob Spee, Executive Director of Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. This is part three of her series.
How many applications do you have as of now, do you think?
I think as of this morning, I think we're right at 30,000. Yeah.
Is there a worry that there may not be enough money to go around?
Is there a worry? I think there's a realistic expectation that there's not going to be enough money to go around. You know, I've been worked with IHCDA. I've been part of the IHCDA thing for 20 years now. I started out at IHCDA right out of IU. And I'm not aware in my 20 years of housing and promoting affordable housing where we've had a program that we had more money than we didn't have the need. I think every program that we have, there's more need than there's dollars. And in this situation, you know, we do want to try to help as many people as we can. And I suspect, though, yes, you're right. There's going to be bigger, larger need than there is resources. But that's unlike any other housing program that we have. But there are resources available. I know that there's other local resources available, too. And that's one of the things I know I'm really proud of. While we, as a state, have launched this statewide rental assistance program, we know in the communities through a lot of our not-for-profits, foundations, United Ways, faith-based organizations, our township trustees, everyone else has also looking to put together some types of housing assistance for those that may not qualify or that may not receive CDA's rental assistance program. They're kind of waiting to see, I think. And I think that's good because I'm glad to hear that. I've heard that across the state now for a lot of folks as they prepare to know that at some point here soon, we'll probably have to close the rental assistance portal because it's not going to be open for in perpetuity. You know, at some point we're going to have to close it. And when it does, you know, a lot more of those folks at the local level will be looking for housing assistance from other organizations. So, you know, I'm really proud of the work that's going on at the local level with our partners and especially our faith-based organizations. And I know our township trustees are gearing up too, ready to help as much as they can. So.
Yeah, and I don't know for sure that this is the case, but in the past, whenever we've referred people to housing assistance, we always have them start at their township trustees. And then whatever the application process is, they may be eligible for other sources as well. So I'm glad you mentioned that because that's an important asset for renters to know about. Is there any advice that you can give for tenants?
We do have a one-pager that explains the rental assistance program for renters. We also have one that explains it for landlords. So if you're a landlord and you're asking questions, we have it already laid out for you. If you're like me, and before you even apply for anything online, you always like kind of know what's being expected of you. Right. So we do have a PDF document there that lays out all the questions for you. It's in English and in Spanish so that you can kind of just maybe do a precursor of what kind of questions are going to be asked so that you're not caught off guard when you start the application process. And I know we say this a lot, but it really is important to have an open dialogue with your landlord. Some situations it may not work, but a lot of situations we know landlords want to work with their renters because eviction should always be last resort. And I think everyone understands that for an eviction for a landlord, it's very costly. You know, they're going to incur additional expense to do that. And they should try to avoid that as much as they can. And renters need to work and try to identify a repayment plan that's realistic so they don't set themselves up to fail with the landlord to ensure that they remain housed. If you need help having those conversations with your landlord, you know, we do have an eviction and foreclosure prevention guide that helps them kind of walk through that discussion. If you're a homeowner, same situation, reach out to your mortgage service provider, whoever your mortgage loan servicer is, and have that same dialogue. We do have mortgage payment assistance that's available for homeowners if you've fallen behind, if you need assistance. That is at 877-GET-HOPE.org, and that's for our homeowners. A lot of renters and homeowners also may have fallen behind on their utilities. And so we do know that utility companies are doing this exact same thing with the repayment plans as well. So make sure that you're are informing your utility provider that you may have fallen behind and you need to establish some way in which you can get back on track. I will mention for the energy assistance program that we offer at IHCDA through South Central Community Action Agency there locally, September 14th is when we will open up the application again so that you can apply for energy assistance. So that's going to be an important date coming up here within the next 4 weeks. I may have just let the cat out of the bag. We really haven't talked about it much in terms of a firm date, but that is the September's when applications will start being received. If you qualify for energy assistance, you can get your normal energy assistance. If your income has been impacted, a loss of income, you could be eligible for an additional $350 benefit as well. And that's on top of the annual benefit that you receive. So that's an opportunity there for renters and homeowners, low income, to make sure that you apply for your energy assistance if it's necessary.
You just named off a lot of resources, and I think, if I'm right, that most of them are at ihcda.in.gov.
You can find them there, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the energy assistance that you talked about being available on September 14th for our area is at SCAP.
Yeah, if you Google EAP, Energy Assistance Program, ICDA, we do have an online application where you can submit it there, and then it'll go right directly to South Central Community Action Agency as well. So there is a portal there.
I will mention the rental assistance portal again, which is at indianahousingnow.org. And I should note that on that website, if people do have to move, there are some lower income housing facilities that people can move to on there. And saying lower income housing facilities sounds pretty bad, but some of the places on the website are actually new and you know, nice places. And they just have to search by their county, correct?
Yeah. You know, the IndianaHousingNow.org website is also a really good tool if you are looking for an apartment. And this goes for renters and landlords. If you're a landlord and you have a unit that's available, you can post it on IndianaHousingNow.org for free. And it's a nice resource so that you can look for all 92 counties, wherever you may be interested in moving to or living. And it's a free resource for landlords. It's also free for renters to go on and to look, you know, specifically what type of unit are you looking for? 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, and there's an ADA, you know, accessible unit.
Right.
And so there's a lot of information there for renters to search. There's a mapping feature that allows you to really do some searching for available units. That was IndianaHousingNow.org. That was actually why we created it, was to really be a resource for renters and landlords to search for available units. We're using it now for this portal, which is great, but because also it's bringing more awareness to the website, because there's also other features that is available in actually IndianaHousingNow.org. Once all this settles down, IndianaHousingNow.org is still a great resource and will continue to be a great resource for renters and landlords for a long time.
And in Monroe County, we always, of course, have a very full market because of all the students. But there are actually quite a number of apartments available right now, at least the last time I checked. So it's definitely a good resource and people should check it out. The phone number in order to complete a rental assistance application is again 844-463-7368. And more information on the subject of rental assistance can be found in the article, Some Renter Help Available as End of Eviction Moratorium Looms, at limestonepostmagazine.com. Thank you for talking with me today, Jacob. I really appreciate your taking the time from running this massive program that is helping a lot of people.
And thank you for the article and sharing this information with the public and for those that need some assistance. And we really do appreciate the work that everyone's doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Katrine Bruner and Diane Walker with help from Melanie Davis.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Kate Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent local news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming, online at WFHB.org.
You too can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for KiteLine, a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system. That's coming up next on WFHB.